Good evening. I'd like to welcome you to our event tonight with our distinguished guest, Anthony Lewis. My name is Ed Bean. I'm editor of the Daily Report and a director of the Atlanta Press Club. Like our event tonight, all of our events at the Atlanta Press Club are open to the public, and I hope you'll take advantages of these opportunities in the future to meet and hear from some people who have some truly important things to say. And just to give you an idea of the kind of guests we've had in the past year, we've had luncheon and evening events with Justice Clarence Thomas, House Speaker Glenn Richardson, Governor Sonny Perdue, Lieutenant Governor Casey Cagle, Tom Brokaw, Dan Rather, Arthur Blank, Time Inc. editor John Huey, Clark Howard, CDC Director Julie Gerberding, and the list goes on, and we're expecting a similar group of speakers in the coming year. Next month in March, we're having a luncheon event with Hamilton Jordan, former White House Chief of Staff for President Jimmy Carter. And again, you're all welcome to attend that event, which is right here in the Commerce Club. And then in April, we'll have a book signing event with Doug Blackman, the Wall Street Journal's bureau chief, who has a new book. And then in May, we have an event that cuts across political lines and with a man who has a truly important and hard job. And that's Mike Smith, the new coach of the Atlanta Falcons. I'd like to give you one more little commercial for coming events, and this is for the Georgia Bar Media and Judiciary Conference. I think all of you have a circular on your chair. This is not a press club event, but it's a bar event, and it actually are some CLE credits attached to this. The Bar Media Conference is in the afternoon, and then in the evening, you're also welcome to attend the annual Weltner Freedom of Information Banquet, which this year honors former AG Michael Bowers and Columbus Ledger Inquirer reporter Jim Houston. I'd like to thank our sponsoring law firm for tonight's event. It is Bondurant, Mixon & Elmore. And I'd like to introduce you now to Emmett Bondurant, who will tell you about our guest tonight.
Thank you. It is really a distinct honor to have the opportunity to introduce someone who, for me, has been a personal hero for something in excess of 40 years, a reason, an explanation which I will give later. Anthony Lewis's career, with which some of you may be familiar, is truly a stellar one. The winner of two Pulitzer Prizes, one in 1955, when he was barely 27 or 28, for writing a series about a young sailor who was denied a security clearance and discharged dishonorably from the Navy. As a result of that series, the sailor was reinstated. This was in the immediate aftermath of the McCarthy era and the communist scares of that period of time. In 1963, he won another Pulitzer for his reporting on the Supreme Court. But it is for something else that he is primarily a hero of mine. What people don't know, and you won't see from his biographies, is that he wrote a seminal law review article for the Harvard Law Review while a Nieman Fellow at Harvard in 1956-57 period, entitled Legislative Apportionment in the Federal Courts. That article, which appeared in 1958, appeared 5 years before the Supreme Court decision in Baker against Carr in 1962. At the time he wrote the article, he essentially was working in a wilderness of the law in which the established law in the Supreme Court of the United States, primarily articulated by Justice Frankfurter, from Cold Grove against Green in 1944, the court had held that dealing with issues of legislative apportionment, whether congressional is in Cold Grove, whether the Georgia County unit system is attempted in challenges to the Georgia County unit system in 1950 and 51, in South against Peters and Cox against Peters, or the county unit system again in 1957 in Hartsfield versus Sloan, nobody had ever attempted legislative apportionment. But the thesis of the article was that this was an issue that courts could solve. This was an issue that threatened democracy. This was an issue that the political branches of government were incapable of addressing because their self-interest was to perpetuate themselves in office, to minimize opposition. To quote one part of that article, it says, the thesis of this article is that the course laid out in Cold Grove, abstention by the judiciary and reliance on the legislative branches to remedy unfairness in districting, is neither required legally nor effective practically. The precedents in the state courts show that the judiciary can deal effectively with the apportionment problem. An examination of the historical materials demonstrates that the right to equality of representation can be drawn from the Constitution, and the evidence is overwhelming that neither the Congress nor the state legislatures can be relied upon to ensure equitable representation. Indeed, there are virtually insurmountable built-in obstacles. The result of that article was, and it became the intellectual thesis for the challenge that became known as Baker against Carr in 1962, in which the Supreme Court, in an opinion written by Justice Brennan, cites Anthony Lewis's article in the Harvard Law Review from 1958 and holds for the first time that the federal courts can deal with reapportionment. And as a result of that one decision, you have what followed: the striking down of the Georgia County unit system, with which we're all familiar, the striking down of malapportioned congressional districts, which in which the Georgia case was the test case, the striking down of legislative reapportionments in which primarily Alabama, but New York and other states were there. But it was the perfect example in which one young reporter, not a lawyer, playing out of his field in a Nieman Fellowship, could take on one of the most difficult intellectual problems of the time and influence the entire federal court system. I would have to add, if it were written today with the current composition of the Supreme Court and the originalists in the Supreme Court, since in 1789 state legislatures were malapportioned in Congress, from that point forward until 1963, the Scalia, Thomas, Roberts, Alito, and probably Kennedy wing of the Supreme Court, certainly Robert Bork had he been confirmed, would have us back where we were prior to Baker against Carr, and we would all be laboring under the county unit system. But that created, in my mind, Anthony Lewis as a person to watch, as a hero in the law. He went on to become a chief reporter for the New York Times for the Supreme Court and won a Pulitzer for that reporting in 1963. In 1964, he published his first book, one that is read widely in law schools throughout the country even now, called Gideon's Trumpet, the story of Gideon v. Wainwright, which was the Supreme Court case which held for the first time that in a non-capital state felony case, a poor man did have a right to the effective assistance of counsel. And that decision revolutionized indigent defense in the courts, though it's taken most states, including Georgia, 40 or more years to even come close to fulfilling the promise of Gideon. His subsequent books, Portrait of a Decade, Make No Law in 1991, which is dealt with the Times v. Sullivan decision, in his most recent book, Freedom for the Thoughts We Hate, which is taking most currently a page from Justice Brandeis in a very thoughtful discussion of the First Amendment in the modern context. Lest you think he operates independently, his wife happens to be the Chief Justice of the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts. And so I expect, while he may be the ruler of the intellectual pages of the New York Times and other places, I doubt if he is similarly ruler at home, and that she is well established in her own right, having authored, among other things, the majority opinion which upheld gay marriage in Massachusetts, which is the landmark case that is being followed step by step throughout the country, and sooner or later will be followed here. But with that introduction, it is really a distinct pleasure to introduce my hero, Tony Lewis.
Well, I'm at Bondurant. There's never been an introduction I enjoyed more. I could be modest and say it was embarrassing, and of course it was, but I really did care a lot about Colgrove and Green and legislative apportionment, and that whole story meant a great deal to me, and it's nice to find somebody who knows about it. It's pretty obscure, and I really appreciate your mentioning it, and of course, you're right about my wife. What she says goes in the law at home. My daughter-in-law and my granddaughter are here, so I don't need to explain to them that my wife, Margaret Marshall, deserves, earns, and fealty, certainly by me, and I was pleased to have her mentioned. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a press club, so I thought I would talk a bit, or lead up to talking about, the First Amendment and the press. Now, it may seem pretty obvious that the press and the First Amendment go together. Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. Those are the free expression clauses of the First Amendment. But it's not so simple. We think of the First Amendment today, I don't know about the people in this room, they're more sophisticated, but I think the average American citizen thinks of the First Amendment as a sort of self-executing gold plaque that was nailed to a tree in 1791 when it was added to the Constitution. And after that, courts would hold anything that was violative of free speech or freedom of the press unconstitutional. Well, just in case you don't know, the first time the Supreme Court of the United States ever enforced the freedom of speech and press clauses of the First Amendment in favor of a speaker or publisher was 140 years later, in 1931. It was not an easy or open road. There were many waves of repression in those 140 years, starting just 7 years after the addition of the First Amendment to the Constitution in the Sedition Act of 1798, which made it a crime to publish malicious criticism of the president, John Adams. It was advertised by its sponsors, the Federalists, who then controlled Congress, and President Adams, who signed the bill into law, as necessary to prevent French Jacobin terrorism from creeping into the United States. That may have a something of a contemporaneous ring to it. But in fact, its purpose was to silence the pro-Jefferson press in the run-up to the election of 1800, when Vice President Jefferson would be the opponent to John Adams. Interesting thing about the Sedition Act is that it prohibited malicious criticism of the president or Congress, but not of the vice president. Another thing that rather disclosed its partisan character was the fact that under its own terms, the act expired on the next inauguration day, March 4th, 1801. Jefferson and Madison campaigned against the act, but not in they did say that they thought it, Madison did particularly, that it violated the First Amendment. But they didn't go to court over it. They didn't do what we would do today, immediately go to court and say Congress has passed an unconstitutional statute. They responded politically. And so it went through most of that more than a century before someone actually benefited in court from the language of the amendment. Let me give you an example of how far things were then from what they are today in terms of our expectations of judicially enforced freedom of speech. In 1917, Congress, at the behest of President Wilson, and I will throw in what may be an irrelevancy, but I like to say it, President Wilson, I think, was the most retrograde civil libertarian ever to occupy the office of president. I grew up thinking he was a wonderful progressive chap who became president and had a sad ending because of illness and the dogged cantankerousness of Henry Cabot Lodge and the like. But in fact, he was terrible on civil rights, civil liberties and civil rights. He was a true racist. And the Espionage Act of 1917 and the Sedition Act of 1918, the second Sedition Act in our federal history, put very sharp limits on freedom of speech. Under the Federal Sedition Act and state sedition acts which copied it, thousands of people were imprisoned during and after World War I for completely anodyne remarks about the president's competence in waging the war or the utility of rationing and other things that we would regard as completely inappropriate for legal recourse at all. But in any event, in 1919, the Supreme Court took up a case of a group of radicals who had thrown leaflets from the top of a building in New York, which criticized President Wilson for sending American troops to Russia after the Bolshevik Revolution. It was political criticism of the most basic kind, criticism of a presidential policy. It's hard to imagine that being the subject of a criminal prosecution today. They were prosecuted under the Sedition Act, convicted and sentenced to 20 years in prison for those anonymous pamphlets, which Justice Holmes dissenting called puny anonymities. He didn't think much of their rhetoric, didn't agree with them. But the important thing is that he dissented when the Supreme Court affirmed those convictions. And 1919, it was the first time any opinion had been written in the Supreme Court treating freedom of speech as a fundamental American value. Now, there's a story that has come to light in a memoir published by Dean Acheson. Acheson was Justice Brandeis's law clerk the year after the decision in this case, which was, some of you undoubtedly know, Abrams against the United States. But a friend of his who had been clerk to Justice Holmes the year before told him what had happened. Holmes had circulated his dissent, and before it was published, three of his colleagues had called on him to appeal to him not to publish the dissent, and they were accompanied by Holmes's wife. Just think of it. Think of it. I mean, it's absolutely amazing. And the four of them appealed to him, as the old soldier he was, they said, not to publish this dissent, which would be against American patriotism or whatever. And Holmes thanked them politely for coming and said he would publish the dissent. And so we have the benefit of this opinion, of which I will read just a tiny bit. Persecution for the expression of opinions seems to me perfectly logical. If you have no doubt of your premises or your power and want a certain result with all your heart, you naturally express your wishes in law and sweep away all opposition. But when men have realized that time has upset many fighting faiths, they may come to believe even more than they believe the very foundations of their own conduct, that the ultimate good desired is better reached by free trade in ideas, that the best test of truth is the power of the thought to get itself accepted in the competition of the market. That, at any rate, is the theory of our Constitution. It is an experiment, as all life is an experiment. While that experiment is part of our system, I think that we should be eternally vigilant against attempts to check the expression of opinions that we loathe and believe to be fraught with death. I put it to you that no one except Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., no one then or since in this country or anywhere else, no other judge could have written that opinion. Just think of the language. It is an experiment, as all life is an experiment. I mean, it's a philosopher's statement, but it's just amazing. Opinions that we loathe and believe to be fraught with death. But notice what it's about. It's about opinions, beliefs, ideas. And so were the cases that followed. Through the 1920s, Holmes and Brandeis dissented, all in cases about ideas. People were prosecuted. Benjamin Gitlow for circulating a pamphlet that Holmes dissenting treated with his usual scorn. He had no hesitation in upholding the rights of people with whom he vigorously disagreed or regarded with contempt. And then in 1929, he dissented in the case that gives this book its title, a case called United States Against Schwimmer. I'll say just a word. You don't mind my talking to you tonight in terms of stories, because that's what the book is, and that's the way I think, in terms of stories. I see Joe Beck smiling familiarity with the stories I'm telling, but I hope you don't mind, Joe. Rosika Schwimmer was an immigrant from Hungary. She loved the United States, and she wanted to become a citizen, but she could not. She could not because she was a pacifist, and the oath of citizenship at that time required the applicant to swear that he or she would take up arms in defense of the Constitution, and she wouldn't swear that. Holmes characteristically began his dissent by saying that he rather doubted that she would be asked to take up arms because she was a woman of a certain age. And then he went on to say that he didn't agree with her views. He knew war was terrible, and he did know. He'd fought in the Civil War. Mind you, it tells you something about Holmes. This is 1929, and he had fought in the Civil War. In fact, he was 88 years old when he wrote this opinion. He was wounded gravely 3 times, and when he died a few years later, his friends found hanging in his closet his Union Army uniform. He knew about war. But he said, I think there's nobility in war, too, and I don't agree with the applicant. But he said, if there is any provision of the Constitution that more imperatively calls for attachment than any other, it is freedom of thought. Not free thought for those who agree with us, but freedom for the thought that we hate. He could have stopped there, and it would have been a memorable opinion, and it would have provided me with my title. But he didn't. He had a few more sentences, concluding more or less as follows. The Quakers, pacifists, have done their part in making this country what it is. And I had not thought before now that we regretted our inability to expel them because they believe more than some of us in the Sermon on the Mount. When I read that passage the first time, I may say it was pointed out to me by Justice Frankfurter, who once gave me the copy of the United States Reports that report told me to read it, and I did. And when I read the last sentence, ending Sermon on the Mount, the hair on the back of my neck stood up. And I think, again, that that opinion is something no other judge could have written. I don't. Plenty of other judges have written wonderful things about freedom of speech, Brandeis in particular. But somehow, Holmes's poetry gets to me the most. Well, that was 1929. And in 1931 came the first case in which somebody won. And that was a woman named Jette Stromberg. She violated a California law against carrying a red flag as a symbol of radical thought. She walked down the street carrying a red flag and was convicted and sentenced to prison. And the Supreme Court, in an opinion by Chief Justice Hughes, reversed the conviction. Now comes the transformation. I told you I was going to speak about freedom of the press, and I hadn't got to the press yet, but now I'm at the press. Stromberg case, like the Schremer case, the Abrams case that I first mentioned, and all the ones in between, were about beliefs, attachment to ideas, opinions. Then a second case in 1931 changed the odds. That case, with which you're undoubtedly familiar, is called Near against Minnesota. Near was J.M. Near, the publisher of a weekly scandal sheet called the Saturday Press. The Saturday Press was a viciously anti-Semitic, very nasty, unpleasant newspaper, whose main gravamen was that Jewish gangsters were in league with corrupt officials of the city of Minneapolis, or St. Paul, or both, in corrupting the city. And the paper was suppressed by judicial order under a curious Minnesota statute that allowed for the suppression of malicious and scandalous newspapers. The regular press, the established press of Minnesota, had no interest in helping Mr. Near and no concern for his newspaper. They didn't want to get into the case, and they offered him no assistance. But in Chicago, Colonel Robert R. McCormick, the somewhat eccentric publisher of the Chicago Tribune, how many of you, I mean, all these landmarks have now faded from memory. How many of you have heard of Colonel McCormick? Oh, most of you have, I guess. Well, you know, he was a bit eccentric. He wore jodhpurs to work every day. He discoursed about the evils of the British Empire. Headline on his paper one election was, "We kept King George out of Chicago," and so on. But he had a real belief in freedom of the press, and he sent his lawyer, Mr. Kirkland, founder of the Kirkland firm, up to help J. Near. And Mr. Kirkland took the case to the Supreme Court of the United States, where an assistant attorney general of Minnesota, James Markham, thought he would do well to focus on the anti-Semitic character of the paper, because Justice Brandeis, though a great fervent advocate of freedom of speech, was the first Jewish member of the Supreme Court. And Markham thought he could make hay with that, but he quickly and predictably learned otherwise, because Justice Brandeis said to him, and this, of course, is not exactly right, but he said, "These people," meaning Near and his colleagues, "have sought to rid the city, so they say, of a pall of corruption. Isn't that the sort of thing newspapers should be doing?" And Markham... Oh, I forgot to tell you, a lot of lawyers in the room, so I'll tell you the beginning of Markham's argument. The First Amendment, as written, of course, applied only to suppression by federal authorities. Congress shall make no law, etc. And it was a question, I mean, all through the 19th century, it didn't apply to state restraints or state repression. In 1925, the Supreme Court had intimated, but not absolutely clearly decided, that it would absorb the free expression clauses of the First Amendment into the 14th Amendment, the due process clause of the 14th Amendment, which governs state action. Mr. Markham began his argument by saying that the First Amendment didn't cover state action, and he went on for maybe 5 minutes. And Chief Justice Hughes leaned down and said to him, "Mr. Markham, it will not be necessary for you to pursue that argument any further." How would you like to have been the lawyer in that situation? Rather unpleasant. Anyway, that was the case. The Supreme Court decided the case 5-4 in Mr. Neer's favor in a landmark opinion by Chief Justice Hughes, which focused on the fact that the newspaper had been the subject of what Hughes called a previous restraint, what we would call a prior restraint. That is, a judicial order which prevented it from publishing rather than punishing it afterwards. Now, you may ask yourself, what is the good of saving a paper like the Saturday Press? Why do we want to keep a scandalous and malicious newspaper in business? Well, the answer to that is exceptionally clear for an accidental reason in the Neer case. Some years after the Neer case, well, many years after, Fred Friendly decided to write a book about the Neer case. Fred Friendly had been Ed Murrow's producer at CBS. If any of you have seen the movie Good Night and Good Luck, you will have seen George Clooney, who didn't look a bit like him, I may say, playing Fred Friendly. Fred Friendly left CBS when Murrow did and went to the Ford Foundation, eventually went to the Ford Foundation as a vice president. One day he was at lunch at the Ford Foundation discussing his proposed book on the Neer case. And from another table, Irving Shapiro, the chairman of the DuPont Company, came over and said, "Fred, did I hear you say you're going to write a book on the Neer case?" "Yes." "I knew Mr. Neer." "You knew Mr. Neer?" "Yes, I did." And it turned out that Irving Shapiro's father ran a dry cleaning store in St. Paul. And one day, when Irving was 10 and was in the store, a bunch of gangsters came and told his father that he had to pay them protection money. And when he refused, they sprayed acid on the clothes. The newspapers, the regular newspapers of Minnesota, did not write about that event. Jay Neer came to the store, talked to Mr. Shapiro and to Irving, wrote a story, published it. The gangsters were prosecuted and convicted. So, as I say, with exceptional clarity, we can say it's worth saving even some not-so-wonderful newspapers. If you want to know how bad the Saturday Press was, you can look at the dissent by Justice Butler, which begins with a footnote, really hair-raising footnote of an excerpt from the Saturday Press. It's not very nice. Now, the key thing to notice that makes the Neer case so striking to me, not just the ground of decision that prior restraints are disfavored and, in fact, almost absolutely barred. Not quite. Chief Justice Hughes said that there were some exceptions to the disfavoring of prior restraints. No one could doubt, he said, that a newspaper could be stopped from publishing the dates of sailing of troop ships in wartime. We'll come back to that in a moment. But what it's about, really, is the substance of the newspaper, not opinion, not ideas, not, you know, just in the abstract, but the right to publish current news about real events. That was a sharp change, but happened to be a change that would have fitted exactly with James Madison's idea of what the First Amendment was about. Madison thought the First Amendment, as its prime function, was to keep the ultimate sovereigns of this country, that is us, the people, informed about government, about the men and measures of government, to hold government accountable. And that's what Mr. Neer was doing, or as Brandeis said, what he said he was doing, and apparently he was doing, at least to some extent. So that's the transition, and today, very much of what we think of as the First Amendment, not all, because freedom of speech serves two functions. I take this, who am I taking it from? I'll come back to it because I've forgotten the name. Joe, somebody tell me, the Harvard professor, the great expert on freedom of speech after World War I. No one to help me, all right. It serves two functions. It enables people to express what they feel they must express to make life worth living. It protects the artist, the playwright, the novelist, the street corner speaker, Miss Schwimmer, the radicals on the roof of the building in New York, and so on. But secondly, it does what Madison was interested in. It keeps open the channels of communication about government and about our society so that the truth can emerge from this marketplace of ideas that Holmes spoke of. Well, I pointed out the exception that Hughes wrote into the Neer opinion for the sailing dates of troop ships. That came to haunt us exactly 40 years later. No, 37 years later, sorry. Neer was 1934, and the Pentagon Papers case was in 1971, when the New York Times began publishing stories about and texts from a secret official history of the Vietnam War, discussing how we got into Vietnam, the origins of the war, in June 1971. 3 days we published, and then the government brought a suit to stop further publication, really a suit in the Neer tradition, a tradition that was rejected in Neer, but the government said the publication of those documents was like publishing the dates of the sailing of troop ships. It was the equivalent of Hughes's troop ships. Of course, the Times said, there's nothing current, it's all history. And in fact, one of the ironies of the case, hardly known, is that 6 months later, the head of the Internal Security Division of the Justice Department, a very strong fighter against communism and threats to national security and so forth, wrote a plaintive memorandum to the Attorney General. He was ginning up some prosecutions of individuals in connection with Dan Ellsberg, Russo, and so on, in connection with the Pentagon Papers. And he wrote this plaintive memorandum to the Attorney General, said, you know, I've been asking the Defense Department again and again to tell me what is so dangerous in the Pentagon Papers. And they keep sending me these completely bland things which don't tell me anything. I don't understand what I'm supposed to do. What are the secrets that are supposed to be so damaging in here? But it was a hard row. What happened, actually, in the case, it was a very amazing accident of chance. A new federal judge named Murray Gerfein came to the United States District Court for the Southern District Court, for the Southern District of New York that morning for the first time, his first day on the bench. He went to the clerk's office and he said, I'm Judge Gerfein, and what am I supposed to do? Well, you've got a case, Judge. We'll just find out what the case is. And the clerk spun this wheel. It had all little pieces of paper in it with the names of cases, and one of them fell out, and he said, let's see, Judge, your case is called United States against New York Times. And Judge Gerfein had been an intelligence officer for the Army, and the Times lawyers and the Times people were afraid that he would be pro-government. To the contrary, He demanded, he kept asking the government, what's so terrible here? I turn on my television at night and I see what's going on in Vietnam, and this is history. I mean, what's the problem? And they didn't satisfy him. And he eventually wrote an opinion saying the Times could publish. Then he was stayed, his decision was stayed. The Second Circuit decided that he should look at it again. The New York Times petitioned the Supreme Court for review. Meanwhile, the Washington Post had started publishing in the absence of the New York Times, which had been temporarily restrained, I should have said, from publishing. And the two cases rushed their way up to the Supreme Court until, on the day, exactly 2 weeks from the day that the case had begun, the Supreme Court decided the case. Maybe the first time an important case had gone through all its stages from trial, from the filing of a litigation to trial and appeal and Supreme Court review in 2 weeks. And by a vote of 6-3, the court vacated the injunctions and the Times resumed publication. Now, today nobody knows what was in the Pentagon Papers. In fact, at the time, nobody really cared much about what was in the Pentagon Papers. It was the right to publish that was at issue and that became the story. Much, I may say, to the understandable dismay of the person who leaked the papers, Daniel Ellsberg. He wanted to get the misbegotten history of how we got into the war into the public consciousness, but nobody paid much attention to that by the time this episode was over. Well, there we are, and I want to read you one more bit from an opinion which will tell you how far we've come from the Schwimmer or the opinion model of the First Amendment, the opinion model of the free speech and press clauses. There were 10 opinions in the Pentagon Papers case, rather remarkable, from a court of 9 people. There was one per curiam for the whole court, which simply said there's a heavy burden on anyone who wants a prior restraint, and that burden hasn't been met, so the government loses. That was that long. And then 9 concurring or dissenting opinions for the individual judges. Justice Black, in what turned out to be his last opinion, he turned fatally ill that summer. This was June 1971. And as it happened, his colleague and often disagreed with him, but who loved him, John Harlan, also was ill, and they went together to the Walter Reed Hospital and died that summer. So this was Justice Black's last opinion. The press was protected in the First Amendment so that it could bear the secrets of government and inform the people. Only a free and unrestrained press can effectively expose deception in government. And paramount among the responsibilities of a free press is the duty to prevent any part of the government from deceiving the people and sending them off to distant lands to die of foreign fevers and foreign shot and shell. It has a ring to it, doesn't it? Deceive them and send them off to die of foreign fevers and foreign shot and shell. In my view, far from deserving condemnation for their courageous reporting, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and other newspapers should be commended for serving the purposes that the founding fathers saw so clearly. In revealing the workings of government that led to the Vietnam War, the newspapers nobly did precisely that which the founders hoped and trusted they would do. That's a remarkable opinion. I can't help telling you a story which has nothing to do with the subject of this talk, but I raised it in my own mind when I mentioned Justice Black and Justice Harlan going to the hospital. After they'd been there some time, Justice Harlan sent for Justice Black's son, Hugo Jr., and said, Hugo, your father and I are going to have to retire. Do you know if he has fixed on a date yet? Because I don't want to retire before him. I want him to have his day. He has done so much for this court and for this country. I want him to have his day in the sun alone. Isn't that an amazing story? I just think it's, well, I react to such human expressions, and you'd have to know how different Hugo Black and John Harlan were. Hugo Black, a populist senator from Alabama, for two terms, he once said to me with tremendous happiness that in his second run for the Senate, I carried every county in Alabama, including the two that stayed with the Union during the Civil War. He was amazing. And the other, John Harlan, Wall Street lawyer par excellence, distinguished, wonderfully kind, generous, but as far from an Alabama populist as you could imagine. Hugo Black thought at the end of his life, believed firmly, that he and John Harlan were related. The Harlans came from Kentucky, and he treated them like a cousin. No proof was ever adduced, but one other story I'll tell. I'm sorry, but they just occurred to me, and I thought it would do no harm to tell them. Once I was in England at the time as the London correspondent of the Times. I came back and I had dinner with Justice Black. And during dinner, he remarked that it was his birthday and that he'd had a birthday card from John Harlan, which pleased him greatly. And I just said, you know, something like, "That's nice, Mr. Justice." And he said, "Do you realize what that means?" I said, "No, I don't." Justice Harlan was blind by then. I'd say virtually, but he was, practically speaking, blind. He had to be read to, et cetera, et cetera. He couldn't see. He said, "It means that John Harlan, under a super bright light that he has in his chambers, wrote out that birthday card by hand." So there are human beings on the Supreme Court, too. And I have a tendency to feel they were bigger in those days. Maybe that's just age catching up with me, but I like to think of them that way, as more generous in temperament. They weren't always nice to each other, of course not. They had quarrels. But the fact that two people who disagreed as often as they did, Black and Harlan, could treat each other with that courtesy is pretty much of a great statement, I may say. I'm going to tell one other story and then I'll stop. I'm telling them just as they occur to me. This is a story that involves a slightly rancid word, but you won't mind because it appears in the United States reports. It must be okay. The case is called Cohen against California. When the case was called in the Supreme Court for argument, Mr. Cohen was represented by Melvin Nimmer, a great copyright lawyer. And as he got up, Chief Justice Burger said, "Mr. Nimmer, it will not be necessary for you to dwell on the facts of this case." And Nimmer said, "Oh, I understand completely, Mr. Chief Justice. I'll content myself with saying that my client, Mr. Cohen, was convicted of whatever for walking through the county courthouse in Santa Barbara, California, wearing a sweatshirt." The year was during the Vietnam War, I should have said. "Wearing a sweatshirt on which was written, 'Fuck the draft.'" Well, of course, that was exactly what Berger didn't want him to say. But he had to say it. He had to say it. If he was going to shy away from saying it, how could he argue that it was okay to walk through a courthouse wearing it? He won the case 5-4. And Justice Black, the great absolutist for free speech, self-described as an absolutist for free speech, dissented. And John Harlan, the conservative lawyer from Wall Street, wrote the opinion of the court in which he said, "One man's vulgarity is another's lyric." I'll stop there. Question, Joe? Yes, yes, questions, please.
Was it Paul Freund?
No.
That's not my question.
No. No. Earlier, 1920. Yes. Indeed. Oh, I did, yes. Your last part of your question has really discouraged me, because I didn't know about the seizure of assets in Britain, shall we say. I knew that there were cases in this country which held that you could not enforce the judgment because the tests for libel were so at variance with Times and Sullivan. What can be done? Persuade the House of Lords that it's time for British libel law to move on. It's moved on some. It's less draconian than it was, but as of, you know, you ask me what's a neat answer to the problem, I don't know, and it really is a problem. I understand it is. I don't remember his name, but there's a businessman in Saudi Arabia who regularly sues in the English courts whenever he's mentioned in an American publication unfavorably. Yeah, that's right. That's it. You said it, but I didn't catch the name. Yeah, yeah, it's terrible. I can't answer your question. I don't have an idea. The name of the professor was Zechariah Chafee, Jr. Light comes eventually to all of us. Yes, sir.
Mr. Lewis, I'm a second-year law student at Mercer University.
You're at the peak of your knowledge. It's downhill from here.
I'm closer to the end of my law career than the beginning, so
he said everybody knows he's guilty.
Yeah, that's what he said. What is your opinion on back when journalists had a little bit more discretion when dealing with a judge or an attorney? For instance, getting back, a judge would give you background information, but you knew that was for education. Your opinion on that is press. And second,
well, let's take one question at a time, okay?
Your favorite Thurgood Marshall story?
I don't know that I have a favorite one, but the first one, I'd say a few things. First of all, judges should not talk to the press while cases are pending about the case. That was a great mistake. He may have thought that the journalist was, having a confidential conversation, but you shouldn't do it. I just will say that as an absolute. I personally don't think the press should publish such stories, but I'm very much alone in that opinion. Nobody else in the press would agree with me. But here again, the comparison with Britain is very telling. Britain had, and purports still to have, though not as leak-proof as it once was, a really draconian system of preventing publication that may interfere with fair trial. The case that I teach is a case in which, around 1940, there was a series of killings in London in which the victims, young women, were found with bite marks in their necks. Well, guess what the tabloid press called it? The vampire killings, of course. After some time, the Daily Mirror, then the leading tabloid paper, published a story. I wish I had the lead with me because it's such a classic of idiocy. The vampire will never strike again. He will not lure any more victims to a hideous death. This the Daily Mirror can tell you. Get the name of the newspaper in the lead paragraph, very important. If you know the front page, that's what happens at the climax of the front page when the demon managing editor, Walter Burns, tears the paper out of Walter Hildy Johnson's typewriter and says, "You didn't put the name of the paper in the lead paragraph." Anyway, and so on. Didn't name anybody and so forth. Somewhere else in the paper, 10 pages inside the paper, there was a little story that said a man named Haig, H-A-I-G, was helping the police with their inquiries in a matter not described, nothing, no reference to the vampire killings. That's all. The morning the newspaper appeared, the editor was summoned to court. He was held in contempt, sentenced to 6 months in prison, taken away from the courtroom, served 6 months, and never went back to journalism again. That's the draconian method of seeing that newspapers don't do that. They don't quite do that anymore, but they do fine British newspapers quite severely. Although, you know, the tabloid press in England. Here, can I have another story? This is in lieu of a Thurgood Marshall story. It's a British newspaper, British tabloid story. A few years ago, The Sun, which has succeeded The Mirror as the largest selling tabloid in the world, Mr. Murdoch's newspaper, had a page one story about Elton John. It said that a rent boy, now rent boy is British tabloidese for young male prostitute. That's rent boy. You know, you gotta know the lingo to read the paper. That a rent boy had come to them and told them all about Elton John's terrible habits. He inhaled cocaine through rolled up $100 bills. He did this and that. And it was all in there. Published that day, Elton John brought an action for libel. 9 more stories over the next few months, each one succeeded by an Elton John libel suit. The last story said that Elton John had had a horrific operation performed on his dogs, Rottweiler dogs, to remove their vocal cords because their barking disturbed him. And he sued over that story. Of the 10 stories, the libel action that was called to court first was the one about the dogs, perhaps because the English like dogs so much, I don't know. But in any event, that case was scheduled for trial on a Monday. That day, The Sun's front page consisted of the following. Sorry, comma, Elton. They paid him £1 million, admitted the stories were all false, and his lawyer's fees, which would be probably another £1 million. And the only apology in the story was, we're sorry we were taken in by a young man like this rascal, Graham X, was the name of their so-called rent boy, who when interviewed for the apology story, the non-apology story, said, I never met Elton John and I don't like his music. That's the British tabloid press. In the back, and then I'll come to you. Can you speak a little louder? That's right.
So our freedom of the press, as far as this particular issue, is very, very restricted.
Your question really leads to another point. I mean, it's an entirely fair question. Freedom of the press does not guarantee us a noble, to use Justice Black's word for the Pentagon Papers stories, or courageous press. The press can be bad, and I'm not talking about tabloid journalism. You know, for example, after 9/11, the leading newspapers in this country, I think, with few if any exceptions, just laid down on the job and didn't challenge President Bush in the march into Iraq, to the extent that after about 2 years in Iraq, the New York Times and Washington Post both published apologies for their indolence and their failure to look into the causes of the war. So it's not a perfect institution. And the only way to get at the kind of stories you're talking about is real enterprise. Now, there are some reporters who try to, you've put your finger on the way you have to do these things. It's no good, some good, I'm not no good, but it's not good enough to do stories about, there are a lot of people out there with inadequate health insurance. You need to tell the story of individuals. That's what gets to people. That's why telling, I find, talking about Supreme Court doctrine in terms of the way individual cases were decided, Rosika Schwimmer or Jay Neer, makes people understand what it's really about. It's about individuals. That's what, you know, that's the kind of constitution we have. So what can I say? I agree with you that the job has to be done. Yes, sir. It's very hard, especially because of what's happened to journalism. Journalists used to be outsiders, freebooters, rascals. They didn't call themselves journalists. They called themselves reporters. And the front page, the play to which I referred earlier, adequately describes them, you know, drinking whiskey from paper cups in the City Hall press room and hiding escaped criminals in the roll-top desk and so on. If any of you haven't read or seen the front page or its, what's the movie called? And Rosalind Russell as the woman version of Our Gal Friday? Yeah. His Gal Friday, sorry. Very good, with Cary Grant as the vicious managing editor, Walter Burns, and Hildy Johnson turned into a woman. And you all know the conclusion of the play. Here I am off on another story again, but Walter Burns, the devilish managing editor, is desperate to keep Hildy, the star reporter, working, but Hildy wants to go off and marry somebody. And finally, Walter Burns, with saccharine phoniness, says, "All right, Hildy, I understand. It's love. So here, take this watch as my gift for your wedding." And Hildy says, but Walter, it's got your name inscribed on it. "Go catch your train. We'll change the inscription later." "Oh, fine." He goes out. Burns picks up the phone, says to the secretary in the office, "Get me the New York Central Railroad. Call your men at whatever the first stop out of Chicago is. There's a man on there called Hildy Johnson. Stop him. The son of a bitch stole my watch." That's the end of the play. Well, that's the cynical view of the old-fashioned view of journalists. And while I'm at it, as I say, they were hard-boiled with no pretensions. Now, today, journalists are full of pretensions. They dine with the great. They are famous, as you say. It's not just that they're part of a story in some narrow sense, like Bob Novak revealing Valerie Plame's name and so forth. But they're part of a system. And it takes really unusual determination to reject those ties and turn on those you may be hobnobbing with. I will tell you that I chose, when I came back from London, I was writing columns and I was going to live in Washington, and at the last moment I decided not to live in Washington because I didn't think I had the courage to resist those lures, the lures of closeness to the great. And I didn't live in Washington. Oh, that was, no, that was before. And that's a fair question, but I wasn't writing columns of opinion then, which is what I was going to do when I came back from London. And moreover, I never got any secrets from Supreme Court justices, nor did I try. I didn't think that was my job. It was just a chat. Literally was. When I saw Justice Frankfurter or Justice Black, it was a chat. They never told me a single thing that I put in a story. Nothing. So, I don't know. Yes, Mr. Bonner. I'd be a fool to be confident about anything relating to this Supreme Court, because it shows such two things. Little respect for constitutional history, and such a determination, amazing to me, to overturn as much as possible, as fast as possible. It's as if the five who made up the majority last term in a dozen crucial cases, 10, I think, like the affirmative action case, the abortion case, so on. As if they thought, we have this majority at this moment, who knows how long it will last, let's write our views into the law as quickly as we can. Now, that sounds critical, and it's meant to be critical, because I think courts should act more slowly to overturn established doctrine, but, you know, I believe in the court, and I'm not going to say that what it's doing is illegitimate. I don't agree with what they're doing, and I can't have confidence that they won't do other things, as you say. But the system is, that's the system. The connection of the Supreme Court to political reality is in the Constitution. It's the appointment process. The president appoints and the Senate confirms. And that's the way it works. If you don't like it, you should have voted for a different president. Yes, well, not enough people had the courts in mind and the candidates, the Democratic candidates, in the two elections that brought Bush there, thanks to the Supreme Court. Didn't do enough with warning about what it would mean. Terms of judicial appointments. I think it's the most important single thing a president does. That's my opinion, and has been forever. But that's the system. Yes, ma'am. How relevant can the Supreme Court be? Internet, like it or not, is a modern, technologically enhanced expression of Madisonian views.
Madison lived at a time when anybody could put out a newspaper, and lots of people did, just by bringing some foolscap to a printer and say, here's my newspaper, print it. It was no great investment. You didn't have to be a billionaire to buy a newspaper or own a newspaper or start one. And he didn't like a lot of things they published. They were very partisan, very nasty papers, a lot of them. They published really vile stuff about politicians they didn't like, and a lot of them were edited by political hacks for one party or another. But he believed in the system, and he thought the answer to bad speech was good speech or more speech, which Brandeis said later. And that's what you have on the internet. It's enhanced by this technical virtuosity. Well, I think it might. Well, it just depends what happens. Let's suppose that somebody tries to do something about a nasty attack on the internet. A blog which says he's a wife beater. That actually occurred. But there was at the time, and I don't honestly know whether it still exists, a statute that was interpreted to bar lawsuits over what was on in blogs. And if it still exists, then you can you can say what you want, even knowing and reckless falsity, knowing or reckless falsification. But assuming that that statute does not exist, a libel action would test whether Sullivan covers the internet. I have no doubt that it does, but it would be very important for the court to say so. You don't think so? Well, it's different. I mean, we tend to think of, quote, the press, unquote, as somebody in a newsroom pictured with, you know, Robert Redford in shirt sleeves and getting calls from Watergate people. But it needn't be that way. We have a citizen army now. That raises very hard questions in another field, which I don't want to get into because it takes too long, of claims of privilege for journalists not to testify about anonymous sources. Does that go for bloggers? Millions and millions of bloggers, when they're subpoenaed to testify, can they say, I'm a journalist? Yes, and he shamed that journalist shamed the press finally into admitting that he was a journalist. The press sort of hemmed and hawed because they didn't want him to be, he's not like us. But then they said, yeah, we got to defend him. So they did. And it turned out, I don't know if you know what the case was about. It was the case that underlay the sports drug, wasn't it? The sports drug scandal. And there was a leak from a grand jury, which this blogger published. And eventually, the leaker was discovered. How was it discovered? Because one counsel to one of the parties before the grand jury denounced the leak and said it and made his client, made it impossible for his client to get fair treatment. And then it turned out, guess what? He was the leaker. No, I don't care. It's a fairly long answer, but I'll do my best to make it short, the last question. First of all, I don't agree with the press at all that the First Amendment includes a privilege for the journalist not to testify. That claim was rejected by the Supreme Court. The chance of the court changing its mind is zero, and I don't agree with that at all. A shield presents a different question, a question of policy. Do we want to give journalists the privilege not to testify? I think it would have to be a very carefully controlled privilege for the following reason. Do it by example again. The Wen Ho Lee case. Wen Ho Lee was a physicist at the Los Alamos National Laboratory. Suddenly the press, print and broadcast, began carrying stories suggesting and virtually saying that he was a spy for China and he'd passed nuclear documents to China.
Well, needless to say, this destroyed Wen Hosley's life. He was fired, and eventually he was prosecuted on 60 counts of espionage and other things. In due course, the government dismissed 59 of the 60 counts, and the 60th count, which was misuse of information that had been retroactively classified, Wen Ho Lee pleaded guilty and was let go. After spending months in solitary confinement, walking around in chains, and generally having his life destroyed, he sued the government for violation of his privacy in the leaks. And he inevitably could not maintain the suit without knowing the names of the leaker or leakers, and he asked the reporters who had written the stories. And, of course, they refused to say. Now, what do we want? Do we want to have a society in which someone whose life has been destroyed like that has no recourse? I don't. I don't want that society. So I don't want to have a shield that would indemnify those reporters or exclude them from having to answer the question. In fact, the case was settled. The trial judge rejected the reporters' claims of a privilege, and the newspapers paid and broadcasters paid Wen Ho Lee $800,000, and the government paid him $600,000 toward his legal fees. That seems to me to be a legitimate resolution of the case, but I wouldn't want a shield law that would allow Wen Ho Lee to have his life destroyed with no recourse. Thank you. I guess they said the last question. Thank you.